and the endless duration of pure being. The great breath, in a way, is the cause of the great illusion. It is the great illusion. The exhalation is the illusion. Inhalation restores one, well, restores who? Let's just say it restores the absolute non-illusory state. The whole universe is an illusion. Caused by the great breath, as the great breath. The instantiation of the absolute is the great illusion. But, of course, this is not as the Tibetan conceives it, because he's talking about illusion within the one. So from this perspective, the one has a state of consciousness which is non-illusory. But looked at from the supercosmic perspective, even the consciousness of the universal logos is illusory, because it proposes as reality that which is infinitely removed from absolute reality, as any instantiation is infinitely removed from absolute reality. Now, I'm sure I'll have plenty of time over the centuries to be thinking about these things and to try to see the error of my thoughts, but one can only do what one can do, and one must make the effort. It seems an imperative. Time is. Being descends to manifest, as ever it has. Creation is, in the utterly abstract and the utterly concrete. You know, utterly, of course, means forever in a way. So there are limits to the degree of abstraction and limits to the degree of concretion. But all along that continuum of abstract to concrete, creation is, in the universal unity and in the greatest amount of diversity possible, creation is. And the being is the creation. Creation is an instantiation of pure being. An externalization, says the Tibetan, of the one infinite being, and he says that in the definition of harmlessness. Harmlessness is the expression of the life of the man who realizes himself to be everywhere, who lives consciously as a soul, whose nature is love, whose method is inclusiveness, and for whom all forms are the same, in that they veil and hide. What do they veil and hide? The light? I'll look it up. And are but externalizations of the one infinite being. That's worth looking up. Externalizations, infinite. Whoops. Infinite. Externalizations of the, let's say, one infinite, infinite being. Yeah. In that they veil and hide the light, yes, and are but externalizations of the one infinite being. There it is. A Treatise on White Magic, page 102, 103. Okay, returning. So everything in our worlds of perception, all the contents of consciousness, of the universal logos and of his extensions, are subject to time. They come to birth and they die away. But pure being within this coming and going does not come to birth and does not die away, and thus does not agree with what we normally call time, even though if we get into the idea of supercosmic time, there must be a way to reconcile the first and second fundamentals of the secret doctrine. Maybe mortal mind cannot do that. But when we begin to think of the great breath as the exemplification of supercosmic time, then and that it lasts forever, throughout eternal duration, then maybe we can come closer to reconciling being and time. Here, within the universe, as I'd like to call it, being and time are not agreeing, are not reconcilable. Being persists, and that which is subject to time does not, in any form, persist, though in essence persists. Unity is. He likes those is's, great assertions of fact, some of them temporary. He's going to come back to God is, as you see. And only God is. All the other is's, or things which are, have a temporary isness, although because they are naught else but God, their isness is in a way eternal. Even the evanescent is eternal. Even the fragment is all of God. Unity is. The one between comes forth and knows both time and God. The time destroys that middle one, and only being is. Well, if there's going to be unity, then there have to be factors which are unified, so there has to be multiplicity, or at least two. You can't have a state of absolute homogeneity and speak of unity. In the same way, there is a certain absolute homogeneity concerning synthesis, and so it is not meaningful to speak of unity when the state of synthesis prevails. Unity is. At a point, a perceiving consciousness is generated. Soul, we might call it. The bringing together of spirit and matter, or God and time, into a perception which reveals them as harmoniously related and ultimately essentially one. It is the soul that is coming forth, whether it is the soul of man or the soul of greater beings or the universal soul, comes forth, and like Janus, the two-headed God, can know that there is pure being and find itself as pure being, and can know that time, variation, alternation, birthing and dying occur. So one eye is toward relativity, and the other eye towards a persistent homogeneity. This operates on a number of different levels. Even the soul of man conceives that there is something it calls God, and conceives that there is something known as time in a world of constant change. We might even say that the soul is poised between perceptions of the world of being and those of the world of becoming, where time and space prevail. In the world of being, such as we know it, which is really for us on the higher levels of the cosmic physical plane, time and space, as we normally know them, do not prevail. I have to use all of these qualifiers because, you know, it's very difficult, the great breath being what it is, it's very difficult to get rid of time and the space, which we call the universe, produced in time. Whenever there is a perception, there is space. The universe is a great perception, and thus an illusion, and thus an evanescence. But the one must come forth. Now, whether this is done in sequence or simultaneously, you know, from the one arise the three. Are they sequential? Or is there a sequence? I've wrestled with this one somewhere in the book. There's arguments for both sides, and arguments, if there is sequence, for that sequence not being, the elements of that sequence not being separated by much, quote-unquote, time. So it is necessary to reconcile spirit and matter and God in the world of time-space. Here only time is being discussed. And there is always a perceiver poised between pure being and activity or perceptual change in time. And this lasts, well, perhaps for the duration of any particular universe. But at length, even as we understand on the human scale, that which we call the soul is destroyed. Of course, in a way, soul is not destroyed. Soul is a universal principle, and there is always consciousness while there is universe. But on various levels, the unity which any particular consciousness perceives, reconciling spirit and matter, appears to be destroyed. And the unification between archetype and mosaic configuration, finally achieved, that unity between the archetype and its expression in the world of becoming, that unity is destroyed. All is breathed back in, and it is no longer necessary for the perceiving consciousness to look in two directions, toward God and towards time. Maybe the eye becomes single in this respect, and the perceiving consciousness looks only towards God, because the processes of time have ended. But even that perception, which is a kind of duality, dualistic, is not allowed to persist, because the perceiver is absorbed into being. I've often said there is seeing and there is being. Being is higher than seeing, more fundamental. Seeing can only exist when there is a kind of duality or multiplicity. After all, what is to be seen? Except ultimately for the kind of self-seeing that I've talked about. Consciousness, what is this? Franklin Merrill Wolfe, the philosophy of consciousness without an object. Well, the seer as the only object of seeing, that state eventually supervenes. But there is something so high in the state of being that it obviates the necessity of seeing. It somehow includes it. So the one who perceives and has come forth and is for the duration of cosmos bent to perceiving the origin and the creative result, that one disappears in time. The duration of the cosmos, which is a timed process, will destroy the middle one, and only being will remain. Now, perhaps it's the being of the universal logos when the one withdraws the apparent three into itself. Before that one is itself withdrawn as a ray of the absolute into pure being or be-ness. So the universal logos, rather than be a three, again becomes a one, and that one, which has consciousness of itself, but something which unites consciousness and activity and the perceiver, is itself abstracted into the ultimate abstraction. In a way, we have to create unity. Perhaps we do this through an act of consciousness, which affects the relation between archetype and the exemplification of the archetype. So, at various points within the universal process, we can say unity, a relative unity, is. And that unity is destroyed so that a greater unity can be produced between more extensive archetypes and more extensive exemplifications of archetypes. One unity after another is destroyed. Wonder, is it ever possible to create a unity between absolute being and the universal process? I think perhaps when the kind of algorithm of any particular cosmos is fulfilled, there is a unity between the intention of the absolute being and the process, its externalized process, which is the universe. After all, the universe does not, the universal logos does not come forward perfected. He comes forward directed, you might say, directed to self-perceive and move all through self-perception into a condition which reflects the algorithm inherent in him and bestowed upon him by the universal, by the ultimate being. When I use word like him, it's just for convenience. At these levels, there's no him, there's no her. It's just cumbersome to keep on alternating the words. Could use it at times. I do. I try not to get too hung up on language. It's the idea behind it that counts. I think when we get beyond our fixation with plus, minus, male, female, positive, receptive, and get into the state of the hermaphroditism of the unitive consciousness, we'll be in a better state to understand the relationship between the polarities and how, in effect, they are but one thing functioning in apparent opposition during time-space processes. So I know there are purists with respect to gender neutral language, and I can certainly see the point, but when I get thinking about these things, I just, they're difficult enough to think about. I just try to simplify the matter if I can. Unity is, the one between comes forth and knows both time and God. Well, that's a good question. You know, can one can know, in a way, God, the universal logos, but can one know God, the absolute being? Anyway, I'm not going to try to split hairs in this way. We can just say that various aspects of soul do come forth, come to a type of perception which is unified, and in which the archetype and its representation are in harmonious relationship, and in which that representation of the archetype reflects the archetype, and that is the state of harmonious unity. Whatever the Buddhic function may be, it participates in this on all levels of cosmos. Not just our Buddhic plane, but the higher exemplifications of the Buddhic plane participates in the unification. The one between comes forth and knows both time and God, or various reflections of time and God as we ascend. Maybe even on the highest levels of the universal logos. The consciousness of the universal logos comes forth and knows all of the universal processes on all levels, subject to time, and knows as much of God as it can. But maybe not the absolute deity, the unknown, which I've said sometimes can only be been, but not be seen. If one wants to know God, one has to be God. And can one be God when the condition of universe prevails? Or can that fragment, which has become the universe and is within the universe and the universal logos, can that ever know its origin until it is retracted into its origin? The time destroys the middle one. We might say that being destroys seeing, and only being is. Which gets right back to God is. Space is. Time seemed to come first. I've always found it more difficult to solve the problems of time than the problems of space. Somehow space seems more manageable. I've come to the conclusion there is supercosmic time. But is there supercosmic space? Well, perhaps when anything occurs, space exists. In other words, when time is, space is. Space is a perception, a self-perception. When there is no self-perception, there is no space. Now I'm speaking of self on a very high level here. I'm saying that the space is a datum of consciousness. When the one universal logos comes forth as the point which is dimensionless, there is no space, except in the sense that some thinkers use that term space to represent the ultimate being. They just call it space. They don't call it time, which seems a slight. You know, time is as great as space, and you can't call that ultimate greatness space and leave time out of it. So I'm not so good with the denotation of the ultimate beingness as space. Although I understand in the attempt to evoke the concept of formlessness, the boundless immutability, space is somewhat suggestive of that. So I consider the use of the word space there a kind of convenience in which, for the moment, I don't want to indulge. Space is, it's like saying the universe is, the universal logos is. But not until the universal logos, as the one emergent perceiver, has perceived itself, there is no space. Space is a perception. And hence, the bounds of the universe are simply the bounds of a perception. Whatever the perceiver perceives is the boundary. And since that perceiver is not infinite, though in essence it is, but since the perceiver is not essence, then its perception is infinite, then its perception cannot be infinite. And hence the universe cannot be infinite. Though that of which the universe is an instantiation is infinitely infinite, beyond all possible, specifiable infinities. There have been those mathematicians who have dealt with infinity, Georg Cantor being, I think, preeminent in this regard, a Pisces man. And he certainly thought there were specifiable infinities. But I'm speaking of an infinity which is the absoluteness and therefore unspecifiable. The infinity of all infinities, which Spinoza implies or suggests in his six postulates of his ethics. Einstein, you know, used to read that book and wrote the foreword to a Spinoza dictionary. I think it was their unity upon the third ray on some level that brought them together. This is a tremendous discipline of thought to read Spinoza. But ultimately, he comes down to a kind of philosophical pantheism in which substance is God. I haven't really made it through the ethics I've labored. I'm working at it. But you know, if you read too many of the books of other people, you never put forth your own formulation. Which is really, what is it? Knowledge dwells in the minds of those attentive to the thoughts of others. And wisdom in the minds of those attentive to their own. Of course, who owns what, you know? We are all but externalizations of the one universal thinker, but each as some emanated externalization of that thinker have the duty to bring forward a formulation based upon the particular internal configuration we represent. So that's another way of saying think for yourself. You know, we all piggyback on other thinkers. Newton was saying that if he has seen more, it's because he's stood on the shoulders of giants, and we've all stood on the shoulders giants. Early Beethoven sounds like Haydn. Early Mozart sounds like Haydn too, because they both, Beethoven and Haydn, but Beethoven and Mozart took lessons from Haydn. But at one point, Beethoven became Beethoven, Mozart became Mozart, and they were true to their internal name or archetype, which it was their duty to register and express. So let us all learn to think for ourselves. We can only be ourselves, ultimately one being, but we can think for ourselves. Space is, time and space reverberate and veil the one who stands behind. Pure being is unknown and unafraid, untouched, for A, unchanged. Space is not always, but space is in the universal process. I kind of wonder sometimes whether the absolute being could not be called using the time-space reference, the ultimate essentialization of time, which is duration, and the ultimate essentialization of space, which is infinite self-perception. Anyway, just puny human concepts, but working with what we can. Space is, in a way, the universe. The universe is a self-perception of the one emergent point that contains all points, that point being the universal logos, and not until the universal logos self-perceives the space as we know it, space as the universe and all its levels come into existence. Existence, it seems a step removed, X, EX, out from, a step removed from being. But we have to be careful because sometimes these words are used interchangeably. Being and existence. We are very careless in our use of words. But one can understand and forgive. There is perhaps no time in life to be too discriminative. We have to speak to each other in a practical way and not with as much accuracy as we are capable. It would slow the process too much. But I guess for philosophers, they have to be careful. And even though using those limited forms we call words, they have to be as accurate as possible. Was it Annie Besant who was pointing to the third ray as indicating accuracy of thought, and the fifth ray as accuracy in action? I think so. Time and space reverberate. That's a word that seems to imply an echo. It implies vibration. It seems to imply multiple soundings in different rooms or arenas. An endless kind of, not endless, but a projected echo, which is to be heard at various levels of immersion. Excuse me. So we're getting into acoustics here. The originating sound and its secondary sound, its tertiary and ongoing sounds, which create the various layers of time and space. But it is a movement, and this reverberation is a vibration. It's not a stillness. It's a motion, and motion seems to veil reality. Hence the fittingness of the old statement, "Be still and know that I am God." When we're caught in the modifications of the mind or of the astral nature, as Patanjali tells us, we don't see reality. So there is a reverberation which captivates the consciousness, perhaps all except the consciousness of the very highest number of gods. Captivates the consciousness, certainly the consciousness of man, and it takes a long time before we can disengage from the movements, the reverberations all around us, in our environment surrounding us. There's the constant perceptions of different spaces and the constant registering of different cycles in time, intervals. It's a constant motion and change of scene which hides the one unchanging being at the ever so behind these reverberations. So the veils are created, and they are veils of movement that we can't see through or beyond, veils of motion, naught could be seen but motion and that which veiled. That which veiled and constant activity, naught could be seen. It's the third ray problem. And the second ray comes along and provides the necessary stillness to neutralize the effect of the motion. So the one who stands behind is surely, in one instance, the universal logos, the one, but in a greater and deeper sense, the one who stands behind is the absolute, the one pure being, the absolute principle, the one without a second, the only one. Being exists alone, naught else is. That one, God, the deity, the absolute deity of these stanzas. That's the one who stands below, behind. And think of it. Motion, motionlessness, motion, motionlessness, or motionlessness, motion, etc., etc. That's the great breath. It itself is a constant motion. It's like the great breath veils the one who stands behind, if we speak in super cosmic or super logoic terms. So the universe itself is a veil in the ultimate sense. It's the product of motion. And in it is perpetual motion. It is itself a motion. From the time the universe comes forth, motion is. And because of that motion, there is a veil for the aspect of the one being immersed as that motion. There's a veil which separates the immersed aspect from the unimmersed aspect. And yet there can be no division, and the immersed is the unimmersed, So, every limited unit of life is the entire infinitude. That's the conclusion there. But for practical purposes, the greatest of all, the unborn, is veiled by the universe. And although there is revelation to be had within universe, first of all, the one who has come forth knows itself, and then knows itself in seemingly endless descending emanative multiplicity. And each one of those emanations seeks in time to know the one from which it came, even though that one be infinitely removed and infinitely veiled from the one absolute that sent it forth. It's a bit of a brain buster to think about the one universal logos as being infinitely removed from its source. But there's a big difference between the one and the infinitude of all infinities. Well, those are far out concepts. For practical purposes, the motions of time and space, the many cycles, the way we perceive things beginning and ending, the way we perceive different spaces, different contents of consciousness, because after all, time and space are contents of consciousness, the way we perceive these things veils first the one who is the universal logos and is, as far as we are concerned, the being. And yet, there is a disk of golden light. We learn that on a much lower level. There is a disk of golden light that we have to penetrate. It's like penetrating the angel of the presence into the presence, even on a low level here. It's the angel of being, not being itself. It's the angel of the presence, not the presence itself. And the universe is a kind of disk of semi-ultimate light, which has to be penetrated at a certain time in generated space in order for the absolute, in order for the emergent one to be withdrawn and abstracted into the infinitescence, the pureness, pure being. Space is, time and space reverberate and veil the one who stands behind. Oh, there's always a higher one being veiled. It can start out as our monad. It can become the planetary logos, solar logos, endless logo. They're all being veiled by various reverberations of time and space. And finally, we reach the point where the universe itself has to be pierced, penetrated, destroyed in order for the final veil to lift, revealing God, the absolute deity. And then, here we have the one who stands behind. Well, we are talking about God, the absolute deity. We are daring to talk about it. Apparently, the author of these six stanzas dared to talk about it too. Dared. Because, you really can't do it. But in attempting to do it, you can come to the point where maybe it's no longer necessary to do it because identification has supervened. So now he asserts what pure being is, unknown. Well, certainly unknown by that fragment which is the universe and which is the universal logos, unafraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of something other afraid of a division within itself, the indivisible, afraid of a division, unafraid, incapable of being compromised, altered in any way, unchallenged, its state, unchallenged, uncompromised. It cannot help but persist to be what it is. It cannot be altered. There can be no taking away from it, no adding to it. It cannot experience loss or gain. Unknown and unafraid. Untouched, of course. What else is there to touch it? You see, this is why it cannot be the Universal Logos. The Universal Logos is a unitary being, a specifiable being. It can be touched. It can be touched in an infinitude of ways. And yet the agreement is, I suspect, that it not be touched. Once ultimate being has come forth as the emergent one, it remains for a time just what it is, and is left, I think, on its own to work out the algorithm conferred, and for A, unchanged. Well, forever. Look, universes come and go. Universal logoi come and go. They go through a process. They are changed. They're born and they die. To die is a change. But it, the great it, the that, the unnameable, the unnamed, you know, in my infinity book, I came up with so many names for the unnamed. Almost a sacrilege, really. I think I had 241 names for it. I shouldn't even stop there, except it's hopeless, because it is really the big zero. It's utterly unnamed. But we call it pure being, okay? For A, unchanged, and that's the only thing, or non-thing, or no-thing, that can remain unchanged, utterly homogeneous, only and ever what it is, and nothing else. And what it is undefinable, but ultimate, or A, unchanged. So space is, it's a veil, just as time is. It's a perception which keeps us in a way from being that which we are. It's an illusion. The whole universe, in this sense, is a great illusion. And space really isn't. But for practical purposes, because the non-illusory must descend into illusion to remain what it is, then space is. Time and space and motions are needed for both. They are motions, in fact. Time and space reverberate. They reflect themselves. They sound. They are somehow impressed. They duplicate themselves, really, in a way. An echo is a duplication. Time and space reverberate and veil the one who stands behind. First, the Universal Logos. Then, when all time and space are absorbed into the Universal Logos, then the veil is of the one who really stands behind. And in all of this, of course, there is no duality, because that one is inescapably the many. So it's just a perception. This whole thing of the universe is a perception. And if it seems different than the ultimate essence, it isn't really. It's only that a limited perception of itself, which the universe is, it's a limited perception of the absolute one, which can, apparently, self-limit its perception just as it can do all things. That limited perception does not last and is a veil upon the perceiver itself. Maybe we can call it the unknown knower. There's some pretty sticky, knotty problems that one can run into. They're just a result of how we think and the limitations of our thinking, I'm sure. Somewhere in my Infinity book, I dealt with many philosophical problems. I can't say that I solved them all. I don't know if I've solved even one of them. But at least to put up what the problems are, that is worthwhile. Because, you know, we can be so confident in our beliefs, not perceiving the errors we are making and the problems we haven't noticed. We can be very confidently in the midst of a great paradoxes, not perceiving the paradoxes. Go on our whole lives believing and believing without applying our mental capacities to solving some of these problems, which would alter our beliefs considerably, could we solve them. So, pure being is. God, pure being. Unknown, except to itself, perhaps. And then who can say what kind of knowing it is that occurs within this infinite essential state? I can't even pronounce the thing. Infinite essence, infinite essential state, irreducible state. Is it a knowing in which being is preeminent? I think all those things resolve together. We cannot differentiate, but certainly unknown by the fragment of itself, which has become the universal logos and its universe. Unafraid, we always say, I'm afraid of, and they always point to something else. Even if that something is within ourselves, I'm afraid of my own mind, I'm afraid of my own power, whatever. We point to something else, and there is no else. Unafraid. Untouched. The untouchable. Think of it. An untouchable in the caste system is the lowest of all castes. Good old green tea. At 3 in the morning, or whenever it is, what is it? Only 2:30. Okay. An untouchable, the sudra, the higher castes of the hierarchy won't touch, won't come in contact, won't walk in the shadow of. But the greatest of all beings, or non-beings, or no-beings, or no-things, or unspecifiables, is the untouched, the untouchable. So, this is a great pair of opposites, isn't it? The untouchables of earth and the ultimate untouchable. And for A, unchanged, there our great confidence comes in. But, you know, some people, some high beings have told us God got lonely and created a universe, endless universes, so there could be aught else than God, something other than God. Not really, not at all, but at least the entertaining illusion of aught else but God. You wonder, you know, we anthropomorphize here, we project upon what we cannot even conceive, and we say, oh, God got lonely, God got bored, God had to have a universe to play in. The externalization of the endless, literally infinite creativity is ongoing. And there wouldn't be a universe without that self-projection into limitation, which is nothing but a reduction of self-perception or self-being. You know, reduce to manifest. You can't manifest the whole thing. It's infinite. You can't do that in time with the great breath and alternating universes. So reduce, reduce perception until you've reduced the infinite down to a one that is up for manifestation as a particular universal logos and its universe. The universe is an infinite reduction of perception, an infinite reduction of self-perception. It's just a one compared to the infinity of infinities. For a unchanged. You know, I'm slogging my way through this. I was inspired, moved, whatever, in the temple some hours ago to say something about these things. Because no matter what I've said in all my life about all the different energies and their actions and interactions, their forms and formulations, their influences upon us, upon each other, all those things, as necessary as they are to promote the divine plan, to promote that aspect of divine purpose which is attempting to work out in a particular time and space, all those things are secondary. I'm, you know, I get choked up every time I think about my teacher. But I remember telling him, Andrew, I'm interested in astrology. Because I was, you know, another quite well-known astrologer who wrote the Blue Star Program. He's been very active in astrology. He, too, was a student of Andrew. I remember when he met him. So he's a Michael, too, and we both share something very dear to us. But I told him I was interested in astrology. He says, well, no. Astrology is fine. It's good. You learn a lot with astrology. But don't get caught in the sideshow and miss the main event. Well, tell that to any good self-respecting astrologer, you know. I mean, you know, to operate here in cosmos, we need astrology and the higher correspondences of it, but I would say that if the consciousness is identified as the one, then one has seen the main event and the sideshow too. One is fundamental. Identification is fundamental. Identification with, identification as, knowing oneself to be the one being. Even the one being that we call the universal logos, that one being. And then think, move, manipulate as you wish. Because after all, this is a game, a dance, a play, a drama, whatever. There's something to be achieved here, something to be created. There's a plan, universal plan, universal purpose. We need astrology, rheology, all the separate energies. We need to combine them, recombine them until the mosaic world reflects the archetype. The archetype on the highest levels of our universe. So let's have fun and let's use astrology. Let's figure it out and let's reveal ourselves to ourselves. Let's make things work according to archetypal plan. We need astrology. We need reality. But don't miss the main event. And the main event, to me, I think to Andrew, I think, is the preservation of the continuity of identification as the one being.